Welcome to the deep dive. Today we're getting straight to the point. Our focus, the core need-to-know information from the Colorado Army National Guard's ARP Leadership Refresher Training Support Package. We're specifically tackling Module 5, Retaliation. This isn't about just reading policy. It's about understanding enforcement and leadership.
Exactly. For every leader listening, this is practical stuff. The goal here is to make sure you grasp and can apply the standards. For prevention, for response, we have to move past just the basics and really look at those corrosive actions, sometimes subtle ones, that stop people from reporting. Actions that wreck unit cohesion.
Yeah, that subtle versus an obvious point, that's the real challenge, isn't it?
Yeah.
This training makes it clear. Leaders need to get the consequences, yes, but also be able to actually explain the types of retaliation and articulate the reporting steps, know the resources, really use everything available to shield the victim.
That's the standard. It's about demonstrating you can follow the policy and not just memorize it. So let's start right there with the official definition. How does the Army define retaliation?
Okay, so retaliation fundamentally involves a misuse of authority. It's when a soldier wrongfully takes or threatens an adverse personnel action, or they might withhold or threaten to withhold a favorable personnel action. And this is done against someone because they reported or planned to report a crime, or because they made a protected communication.
Right, protected communication. That term is crucial. It's like a shield for whistleblowers, and it covers a lot. Basically, it's any lawful communication to Congress or an inspector general, the IG, or it's sharing information that you reasonably believe shows a violation of law or regulation, think sexual harassment, discrimination.
But it goes beyond that too, right?
Oh, yes. It also covers reporting things like gross mismanagement, wasting funds, abuse of authority, or even a significant danger to public health or safety.
So the protection isn't just for reporting an assault itself. It's much broader, encouraging people to speak up about systemic problems too.
It is. Which brings us to personnel action. We need to be really clear on what this covers because it's easy to think it's just about, you know, formal discipline.
But it's way more than that. If it can impact your career, it probably counts.
That's the heart of it. A personnel action is defined as any action that affects or could potentially affect a member's job or career path. So that's promotions, disciplinary actions, yes, but also transfers, performance reviews, pay decisions, training opportunities, even being referred for a mental health evaluation if it's done punitively or to manipulate. It really aims to catch any kind of official career sabotage.
Okay, that list feels pretty comprehensive for formal actions, stuff you can usually track with paperwork.
Yeah.
But where does the policy go next? How does it handle the, let's say, the social climate in a unit? Because that's often harder to pin down.
And that leads us straight into the three specific types of actions that count as retaliation under policy. They're laid out very clearly in the training. The first one is what we just discussed, the adverse or unfavorable personnel action. The official stuff.
Right. So what are the other two? The ones that aren't about official paperwork but are just as forbidden.
The second is ostracism. Now, this is the official term the policy uses. It means excluding someone, a victim, or another member from social acceptance, from privileges, even friendships within the unit. But here's the critical part, the motivation. It has to be driven by an intent to discourage reporting a crime or to otherwise block the proper administration of justice.
Ah, the intent. That's always the tricky part to prove, isn't it? So if someone's spreading gossip about a victim but says, oh, I was just venting, an investigation has to show the motive was actually to silence them or interfere with the process. This kind of social exclusion, ostracism, it feels like the hardest thing for leaders to really clamp down on because it's often subtle, happens behind closed doors. What's the third action?
The third one is defined as acts of cruelty, oppression, or maltreatment. This covers actions taken against a victim, an alleged victim, or even someone else associated with the case by peers or others. And again, the key is why it's happening, because that person reported or is just believed to have reported a criminal offense. This could be anything from direct harassment to aggressive rumor mongering.
So policy puts gossip, social freezing out, and general maltreatment on the same level of seriousness as, say, denying a promotion or initiating a punitive transfer.
Oh.
Why such a strong stance on the social side of things?
Well, because frankly, social pressure is incredibly effective at shutting down reporting. Maybe the most effective way. When you have retaliation, reprisal, ostracism, maltreatment, these things fundamentally break down good order and discipline. They just shatter unit cohesion. And crucially, they send a chilling message across the entire force, deterring others from reporting sexual assault in the future. If leaders don't police the unit's culture, the social environment, then all the official reporting channels and protections become almost meaningless.
That makes total sense. The system can't work if the culture punishes people for trying to use it. Mm. Okay, to really make these definitions stick and to see how challenging this can be in practice, let's look at the vignettes used in the training materials. Can you walk us through civilian vignette 6? These are some crazy rumors.
Sure. In this scenario, you have Staff Sergeant Smith, who reports being sexually assaulted by Chief Warrant Officer 4 Balloon. What happens next is the unit climate turns toxic online. Other unit members, including her own supervisor, Master Sergeant Tellall, start gossiping. They spread rumors about SSG Smith's past, her sexual history, and even post things on social media, Facebook, Twitter, supporting the accused and attacking her.
And the victim clearly states she feels retaliated against because of all this online abuse. Where's the leadership failure here? What policies apply?
This is textbook ostracism and maltreatment. The leadership failure starts right at the top, well, at her supervisor level, with Master Sergeant Tellall actively joining in the gossip. That's unacceptable. And using social media to spread rumors, especially attacking the victim's character and history like that, it's clearly designed to create a hostile environment, discredit her, and discourage the due administration of justice, as the definition says.
So what's the immediate required action in that situation?
Well, SSG Smith did the right thing. She reported this behavior to her SARC, the sexual assault response coordinator, or her victim advocate, the VA. Those are the primary first points of contact. But the really crucial piece for leaders to understand is this. Allegations of retaliation specifically fall under the Inspector General's purview for investigation. The IG handles these. That immediately escalates it beyond just the local command chain.
Okay, let's shift to the second scenario. This one highlights the trickiness around personnel actions. Civilian Vignette 7. My words fell on deaf ears. Here we have Miss LaWanda Purple. She's a new mechanic, but she has 8 years of experience. She notices she's being consistently left out of special projects that only her male colleagues get assigned to. After this happens multiple times, she files a formal discrimination complaint with the Equal Employment Opportunity Office that's a protected communication. Then, almost immediately after her supervisor gets interviewed as part of that EEO complaint, Mrs. Purple is moved to a completely different team across the building.
Yeah. This scenario really gets at the legal tightrope leaders walk between legitimate management decisions and unlawful reprisal. When you see an adverse personnel action like this transfer, this change of duties happening right after someone makes a protected communication, it creates a strong presumption of retaliation. The timing is suspect.
So let's say the supervisor argues, look, the move had nothing to do with the complaint. Her skills were needed elsewhere. We had to reorganize the team for mission needs. How does an investigation handle that? How do they sort it out legally?
Okay, the investigation, which would start with the EEO in this case, has to look at two things at the same time. First, was Mrs. Purple actually discriminated against initially by being excluded from those projects? That needs determining. Second, and this is key for the retaliation part, the supervisor has to provide clear, convincing, and most importantly, documented non-retaliatory reasons for that transfer. The whole thing hinges on the timing and the justification. A leader absolutely must have documentation explaining why that move was necessary, completely separate from the EEO complaint, if they want to overcome that legal presumption of reprisal.
So the big takeaway for leaders isn't just knowing the definitions. It's about acting immediately to protect the victim the moment they hear about potential retaliation, even before it's proven. And critically, documenting every single management decision meticulously, especially if it happens near the time of a protected report.
Absolutely. The policy couldn't be clearer on this. Everyone in the victim's chain of command, officer and enlisted alike, must take appropriate steps to protect that victim as soon as they're aware of allegations. Retaliation, reprisal, ostracism, maltreatment. You hear about it, you act. It's not optional. And all reports of retaliatory behavior have to be investigated, period.
Okay, so if a victim is experiencing this, or if a leader becomes aware of it, what are the immediate channels they should use? Where do they go to report it or get help?
The primary points of contact for the victim are the SARC, the VA, or the Inspector General, the IG. They can also go to their immediate commander. Or if they're uncomfortable with that, they can go to a commander outside their chain of command. They can even reach out to a SARC at a completely different installation. The SAFE helpline can help facilitate that connection. But remember, for the retaliation allegation itself, the IG is the one mandated to investigate.
And we should also remind folks about the specific legal tools available to service members, right?
Yes, definitely. Service members always have the right, under Article 138 of the UCMJ, the Uniform Code of Military Justice, to file a formal complaint if they believe they've been wronged by their commanding officer. That's a powerful protected process.
And what about situations where the alleged retaliation leads to something really severe, like an administrative separation that could end their career?
There's a specific DOD instruction for that, 6495.02. It allows service members to request a review by a general or flag officer if they face admin separation as a form of retaliation. But there's a condition. Separation action has to occur within 1 year of the final outcome of their sexual assault case. This provides a high-level check, ensuring a senior officer looks at situations where someone claims their career was ended because they reported.
Okay, we've covered the definitions, the three kinds of adverse actions, the official ones and the social ones, like ostracism and maltreatment. We've looked at those key examples and laid out the reporting options. The knowledge seems clear on paper, but making it happen in the real world, applying it, that requires more than just knowing the rules.
Exactly. And the training material itself recognizes that just sitting and listening to policy often doesn't translate well under pressure. That's why the Cochrane training includes dynamic approaches like the challenge room. It's described as a live-action, team-based event where people have to solve puzzles based on applying Army policy in scenarios.
That sounds like a much more effective way to build that muscle memory for handling these situations under stress.
Yeah.
What are they actually trying to measure with exercises like that?
The stated goals are pretty clear. They want participants to demonstrate behaviors that align with the program's values. They want to see people correctly applying the policy knowledge, not just reciting it. And importantly, they want to see effective bystander intervention techniques demonstrated in realistic situations. It's really testing agility and application, not just recall.
So if knowing the policy is just the starting point, the real standard for leadership is demonstrating ethical, policy-compliant behavior. It's about using the terms correctly in conversation, intervening immediately when you see that social punishment happening.
That's precisely it. The ultimate goal is to move from just knowing the policy to effectively being the policy in your actions. If a leader spots maltreatment or ostracism starting up, the intervention needs to be almost reflexive, not something they have to stop and think too hard about.
Okay, let's leave our listeners with a final thought, something to take back and consider within their own organizations. If we know that policy knowledge and ethical application can be tested and reinforced through these kinds of team-based critical thinking exercises like the challenge room, then what real life, maybe even low stress, daily activity could you implement in your unit or workplace to regularly flex your team's mental agility? How can you keep these crucial ethical fundamentals fresh in everyone's mind? How do you make sure that intervening against retaliation becomes an internalized reflex, not just a response read from a script?